There's a binder somewhere, a campaign planned, orders drafted for the Cadillo's pen. They have said as much. If you have spoken out loud or read strange books that are outlawed or your papers are just a little flawed, they may take you. Those kids who held up signs about Gaza may stand tearful in long lines awaiting their own disappearances. I see the polls, but don't like the chances. Speak hopefully, but fear it'll all go wrong. Deaths may be for as little as a song. It happened to Victor Jara so long ago in an East Toronto kitchen where the guests were Latin American. I met two brave, hopeless Guatemalans seeking help from churches and unions for human rights back home. Michael Cherney's friends, people he'd met on his journeys into the killing grounds. One man had lost his brother to the squads, the usual cost of speaking out of turn in a lawless place. Young as I was, I could see in his face, with everything else he'd had to endure, the anticipation of death. I'm sure it came. This war, too, may come with a touch upon the shoulder. They have said as much. The bit at Shiloh Battlefield winds up the sequence. One of the curiosities I found visiting battlefields in the States is that most of those who go see them tend to be white and of a certain age. And talking to the people, I realized there was an awful lot of Vietnam War vets. And there was a very strong feeling among them that these battlefield cemeteries should include the Confederates, and that they should be understood as honorable because they believed in a cause. Now, I don't buy that. I truly don't buy that. And one of the themes of the book, and again, it's an awfully political, historical book, of course, with my own troubles traipsing through, is that the Civil War in the United States never did end. And I don't know if you remember the Ken Burns documentary, but there was a historian in it named Barbara J. Fields. And she said, when asked about how the war ended, what were the events, she said, the Civil War hasn't ended, and it can still be lost. Wow. And, maybe it can. No, not maybe it can. It can. Just read a little bit about that. So I wasn't sympathetic to the idea of honoring in an extraordinary way the deaths of Confederate soldiers and celebrating the places where they are. Here's what I had to say about it. Under persimmon, mockernut, hickory, poplar, white oak, sumac, and black cherry, I walk into the forest near Wolf Field along a path that takes me into the concealed places of the chimney swift, the barn swallow, the white-tailed deer, and the armadillo. It opens onto a patch of grass where cannonballs mark the long boundary of a common grave, one of five they've found, where nameless graves were stacked head to toe. I cannot guess what was felt back home on each small farm that had sent a son, inconsolable harm done to those who love them. And yet pity alone isn't right. There's no nobility in what they did, and most would not have flinched later to see a human being lynched. And the closing section. I wonder if anyone ever left Rome and crossed a distant frontier to reach home in a land not yet subdued. I'm turning north into Kentucky, and tomorrow morning we'll set off again, and if all goes well, by evening past the 49th parallel into what I believe is difference. An imagined line isn't much defense against a mad emperor who's come back from exile and is beating the drum of civil war. I have made my gesture. It began with longing for my own cure, which has come, I think, but the world's hope is less now. What if a few chords on an old guitar or the low chanting of some psalms becomes the last hiding place of what is just, to shape into a rhyme or a run of notes what was best in our time? The old people knew more about sorrow than we do, and they found ways to throw their broken hearts into song and story. It's a brave notion. I have the luxury of refuge for now, if a war draws near. I think it has already started here. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Richard. That was such a powerful reading. That was fantastic. Thank you. I'm so excited to read that book. I want to thank again, maybe another round of applause for Richard and Vera and Michael for their fantastic work. And another round of applause for the brave people who have an indie bookstore here in Kingston, Oscar and Joanna. Stick around for a moderate amount of time and have a beverage or some delicious treats and check the shelves out. And the three authors' books are at the front. And thank you so much for all of you to come out here. It's been such a great evening. Really appreciate that you came out on a cold night. Thanks.
And you just heard from a March 19th book launch at Novel Idea Bookstore and as emceed by Stuart Ross. Readings by Michael E. Castiles and then launching their books. Readings by Vera Hadzik from her several small animals enclosed in a Benedictine monastery. And Richard Green from his Cannibal Rats. It is about almost 7 minutes. Well, maybe it is 7 minutes, actually, after 5 o'clock. And first thing I'd like to do is thank all of you for tuning in to the first segment of the show today. Also, thanks to Stuart, Vera, Richard, and Michael for that wonderful event and to Novel Idea for always hosting incredible happenings here for both writers and readers. And I hope you can stay tuned for the second our second portion of this show coming up in just a couple of minutes. It's going to be another launch event that was held there. Before I play a very quick recording here, just want to say you are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC. Just a reminder, I upload both hours of this show to my personal blog space for it. Those do remain there 3 years at Finding a Voice on CFRCFM.wordpress.com. I usually do that by 7 o'clock, but I can tell you tonight it will be closer to 9:30, 10 o'clock, because I'm going straight from here to record another book launch at Novel Idea. So anyway, let's do this really quick, and I'll be right back.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
And more officially now, as we move into this second hour of the show, it is 9 minutes now, or right at it, after 5 o'clock. And again, you are listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce, and I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And from a again, a Novel Idea book launch held on, I believe it was April 19th. Is that what I decided? April 18th, I think, at Novel Idea Bookstore. You're going to hear Arthur W. Gulakson reading from his new book, Volume 2 of The Defeat and Attrition of the 12 SS Panzer Division, Hitler Jugend, it is Let me get this set up here. I've got a little adjustment to do here. You, again, thank you for tuning in today. And in case you missed the first hour, those will be up on just about have it here. This is very touchy. This is like not quite brain surgery, but it's pretty delicate. Here we go. Let's see what we've got here. That's about as close as I'm going to get it. Let's go ahead. There were some other things ahead of this. So anyway, let's go ahead and just jump into Arthur W. Gulickson's book launch that evening at Novel Idea. Here we go. I hope I got this right.
Everyone who came out to see me this evening, this is another book on the Germans in the Normandy campaign, and the second in a trilogy that will end with the German defeat and the beginning of their flight from France in late August 1944. The subject of this book, a German armored division of Hitler's Second Army, the Nazi Waffen, or Armed SS, the military wing of the Nazi Schutzstaffel paramilitary security organization, is presented as a historical case study to illustrate to readers why the Germans lost in the Normandy campaign, how their attempt at a static defense with some of their best mobile divisions was an exercise in futility. These divisions, pinned in place to contain the Allies, were simply bombarded to pieces by Allied artillery firepower. This division, 20,000 strong on D-Day and formed from a cadre of Eastern Front veterans and populated with former Hitler Youth, Hitler Jugend, members of the Nazi youth movement born in 1926, thus giving the division its title, was quite simply ground to a pulp. This Anglo-Canadian war machine in Normandy was a fearsome thing, and often in a slow, methodical manner, simply bombarded its way to victory with high explosive. The Hitlerjugend was, during this period studied in this volume, 12th of June to 12th of July, pummeled by a series of British and Canadian offensives, backed by massive artillery strikes from the sea and land and fighter-bomber raids from the air. These were followed by Anglo-Canadian ground attacks made by large numbers of tanks and men, each one more powerful than the last, and in touch with the spirit of a British Army cavalry charge, were often given operational names from famous British horse racing venues, such as Windsor and Epsom. During these attacks, this German armored division was forced to carry out a static, entrenched defense with its infantry component of the SS Panzergrenadier, and launch armored counterattacks with the tanks in its possession, taking heavy losses in each engagement, and being forced to relinquish land it was charged with holding, it being overwhelmed. Due to the inability of the Germans to reinforce their combat divisions in Normandy with fresh reinforcements on a regular basis, each time a tank or infantryman was lost, the Hitlerjugend, as an organization, became weaker and less capable of carrying out the mission with which it was charged. The strengths of German units simply melted, like snow in a Kingston April rainstorm. One of the biggest casualties was the death of the division commander, Brigadenführer Fritz Witt, who was killed by fire from the Royal Navy cruiser HMS Belfast on 14th of June. The loss of leaders like Witt made the division less and less effective, while individual initiative and combat aggression went a long way. The experience and leadership at all levels suffered during times of great crisis. While the Germans had some nice tanks in Normandy, their infantrymen made the most of their excellent MG-42 machine guns, and they used their 80mm mortars to launch endless volleys at the British and Canadian soldiers. They were terribly outmatched in virtually every other respect, and would endure a series of defeats in late June and early July that are chronicled in this book, these events being harbingers of the horrendous casualties would suffer in the Battle of the Falaise Pocket, the event that would conclude the Normandy campaign. But rather than stand up here tonight with a bunch of maps indicating German and Allied units and point to villages and towns you're not familiar with and show arrows and lines indicating attacks and defensive positions, I want to do something a bit different. Tonight, I'll talk about the human element and the suffering of the combatants on the front lines. I also wanted to dispel any perception that modern war in the last 100 years was a glorious pursuit, the image of which today is made more safe, sanitized, and yet very entertaining with the console video game systems younger people play online, where you stay seated in a nice comfy chair or under a blanket, warm and safe, and always ready to respawn if a mistake causes your avatar to be killed in some horrible way on screen. Before discussing the conditions of the soldiers, though, it's best to describe the ground present in northwest France in the Calvados. The ground in this area of Normandy in the summer of 1944 varied from east to west. In the place of wire fences that we see today on farms in Canada, large hedges of earth, bushes, and small trees were built or planted over hundreds of years by French peasant farmers to define their fields. In some areas, the fields were much, much larger. The closer you got to the major city held by the Germans in front of the eastern portion of the Allied bridgehead, Caen. In these large open areas, tanks, machine gunners, and artillery forward observation teams could ply their trade. In areas similar, terrain-wise, to the fields of large farms near London, Ontario, and use their weapons at maximum range. But the further west you went from Caen, the fields became smaller and smaller, and dividing hedgerows called bocage became thicker and thicker. Also, the ground began to undulate, and roads were often sunken lanes with earthen walls on either side. Railway lines were often raised as well, with underpasses present for road crossings. This made it sometimes impossible for tanks to traverse their turrets or to see the enemy approaching at long range. And for a complete armored regiment's ability to maneuver and conduct advances, things were terribly complicated and curtailed. Infantry combat was often carried out at increasingly short ranges, and the inability of an officer to see the ground ahead of him or sight enemy positions made everything so much harder. And the life of a German infantryman in Normandy was, due to the campaign being largely an artillery war, at times subterranean, with the Waffen SS, SS Panzer Grenadier scurrying about during the day, improving their positions, but always ready to jump back into them at the howl of incoming artillery fire. While the First World War had extended trench lines and barbed wire, the German positions consisted of outposts and were in depth, with the real position of an SS Panzer Grenadier company sometimes hundreds of meters back from the forward outpost line. Nighttime, with the darkness blinding the Royal Canadian Artillery forward observers, and it being time when the RAF and RCAF fighter bomber pilots were asleep in their bunks, became day for the Germans. This was the time of activity, with medical evacuations, supply runs, messengers going back and forth, and the redeployment of units as patrols and occasional night raids on Allied positions took place. I should also mention the psychological and morale issues present for the infantry soldiers of the Hitlerjugend. Fatalism was a severe problem for many officers, non-commissioned officers, and average soldiers the longer they're in combat. These men became disillusioned as they realized they're fighting a losing battle against an overpowering enemy, the Anglo-Canadian forces, which had endless materiel. Resources. And most terrifyingly for them, a bottomless pit of artillery shells. These men eventually face death, horrible wounding or capture, or sometimes a combination of the last two items. By now, the arrogance of the Waffen-SS in the first bridgehead battles in early June was now long gone, and the German units were simply in survival mode. It can be argued that their political indoctrination, their perceived role in securing the existence of a thousand-year Reich, the importance of defending the fatherland, now under direct military threat of invasion more than ever following the events on the Eastern Front during early summer 1944, drove them on to attempt the impossible, to hold back the Allied attacks, survive, and continue to inflict heavy losses on the enemy. As young men, the former Hitler Youth were also deeply knowledgeable of the bombing raids taking place in Germany during the years 1942-43, and had seen many family members' homes or that of a relative destroyed. While they could not stop the bombers hitting Germany night and day, they could now resist on the front lines. It was their chance to do something. With their minds twisted by Nazi propaganda and taught to believe unquestioningly in the party's leader, Der Führer, Adolf Hitler, they believed this. In German, Das Vaterland, wir siegen. Und dieser schreckliche Krieg, dann von anderen aufgezwungen wird, wir ein Land finden. The fatherland will be victorious in this horrible war pressed upon us by others. You see the insanity that will come back, come to an end. This is taken off a dead SS Panzer Grenadier, you know, one of their writings. There were also the physical effects of receiving sustained artillery bombardments. Relentless Allied field artillery and naval gunfire had a devastating impact, leaving many unwounded defenders stunned, concussed, and unable to respond effectively when the artillery stopped and the Canadian tanks and infantry appeared in front of them. We all know how we feel and begin to perform when tired or exhausted, and the nature of the harassing artillery fire made it simply impossible to have uninterrupted sleep for more than 1 hour at a time. The Germans in the front lines became zombies, staggering around their defensive positions. The infantry was also forced to take part in the artillery war in a way that was never envisioned. Due to the weakness of German field artillery, that is the number of towed guns, operated by artillery crews to the rear of the front lines and well supplied with enough shells, the small infantry howitzers and mortars held at the SS Panzer Grenadier Battalion level were pressed into intensive service to attempt to match the artillery fire endlessly poured down by the Allies. But this was to no effect. And these weapons, too, were slowly destroyed by Allied artillery fire that was never ending. The famous German tanks of the Second World War, the Panzers, were at times literally the only things holding back the Allied forces, firing intensely at everything to allow the German infantry to hold their positions. It is accurate to say that if the Normandy campaign would have ended much sooner if Tiger tanks and Panther tanks had not existed, but as far from an ideal armored knife type of existence for the tank's crews either, where you were secure inside a metal shell, dealing death and destruction. To the enemy at long range. This was sometimes the case due to the excellent long-range tank cannon and armor on some of the German tanks, but for the average Panzers, the Panzer IV and Panther among them, these vehicles had areas vulnerable to anti-tank guns, and with regards to strafing fighter bombers with 20mm cannons, the turret roof and engine cover could be easily penetrated. This meant that a crewman could be doing his job 1 second, and then have his leg or arm ripped off the next, or be trapped in a confined inferno due to the stacks of ammunition and gas tanks that the crews were literally on top of due to tank technology in the year 1944. When not in action, the crews, cognizant of the weak turret roof armor, had to sleep and rest under the tanks. In a hole they would dig and then drive the tank right over top of. The conditions for the tank crews were in some ways far worse than the infantrymen, as the roaring, creaking beasts were huge targets on the battlefield and drew every type of fire. The question was not if a tank crewman would have to exit a burning tank fast enough to save his life, but when. If you're an artillery gunner, this is perhaps the best combat arms trade to be if you're an Allied soldier, as the power of your artillery would eliminate or silence any counter-battery fire, which is fired by your artillery weapons on enemy gunners to take them out. For the Germans in this role, it meant certain death. The Allied counter-battery fire rained down on any and all German artillery positions that were detected, and due to shell shortages, the German units could not fight back with the same type of firepower, often abandoning their guns as Allied forces approached, the tractors to tow them away being long destroyed. And where did officers fit into this? In the face of Allied bombardments, the ability of the commander to do his job, to securely communicate and issue commands and reports, was inhibited. The Allied artillery forces would triangulate radio signals and then deliver massive firepower on any point, origin point of the signal. The Germans then began to depend exclusively on telephone landlines that connected bunkers, but these lines were soon destroyed by artillery fire or cut by Allied tank treads. During Operation Epsom, one of the most powerful British offensives described in this book, the commander of the Hitlerjugend, after Witt, the second commander, the famous war criminal, Sonderanführer Kurt Meyer, was trapped in a ditch after attempting to visit the front lines to assess the situation. He's forced into this ditch for hours to save his life, and then all thoughts regarding his role or responsibilities disappeared as he clawed at the earth in search of shelter. Touching on a factor that made all Germans constantly have their eyes trained skyward during the daylight hours, the Allies had absolute air superiority during large portions of each day, and there was good when there was good flying weather. While some German fighters and bombers attempted to combat the overwhelming numbers of Allied fighter planes, little progress was made over the months of June and early July. This situation forced German troops to move only at night. Any daytime movement was immediately targeted, if not completed quickly. This was often ignored by the German tank crews during the heat of combat, and they used their radios as well, but large organized road move by German tanks, trucks, half-tracks, and the like would immediately be set upon by endless waves of strafing piston engine fighters. And what of the German logistic effort? The Germans did try to adequately supply the material war going on in Normandy, but many factors worked against them. The French resistance actively sabotaged railroad networks and telephone lines, while Allied bombing, most notably the transportation plan, air offensive, wrecked supply routes. Bridges were constantly destroyed and railroad engines shot or simply rocketed right off the tracks. Soldiers frequently ran out of ammunition and fuel, with some reports suggesting half of German tank losses were simply due to mechanical failure or a lack of fuel rather than combat. Simply not enough shells and spare parts reached the front. And Allied artillery fire, the force that was the decisive factor in the Normandy campaign, became even more dominant. The lack of an effective rail network in northwestern France meant that soon that all logistics in the combat zone depended on one thing, the 19-year-old truck driver with several barrels of gasoline or 40 artillery shells bound for the front from a depot outside of Paris, traveling with blackout lights on his truck in the middle of the night. Sooner or later, a fighter-bomber pilot spotted every truck driver, and this turned out to be one of the most dangerous jobs in Normandy for a German enlisted man. So, in conclusion, I have attempted here, in the course of a short speech, to illustrate what life was like for the average German soldier on or near the front lines in Normandy, as the forces working in unison to end, as the forces against the Germans worked in unison to end that young man's life. As I continue to teach at RMC, and as a result of the endless study of wars and conflict, its ugliness becomes more and more apparent. The waste of life and sheer effort spent by one group in attempting to exterminate another is mind-boggling, and a testament to our inherent desire as humans to wreak death and destructions at times on others. In writing this book, part of my main focus was to illuminate something not touched on very often by Anglophone historians of the Second World War, and very rarely discussed in our nation, which is sometimes, in other places other than Kingston, very unmilitary. Until recently, our troops, you know, were seen as peacekeepers for the UN, marching about in blue berets. And my purpose with this book was to illustrate what it was like to be on the receiving end of the weapons of the Canadian-British militaries during the World Wars, now further fading into history with every year, and the sheer level of lethal combat power brought to bear to end human life. Thank you for having me. I'm Dr. Arthur Glax of the RMC History Department. Well, thank you very much, guys, for attending, and I'll take any sort of questions you may have now. Oh, right there at the back. Hello.
I was interested to hear at the very beginning where you said that some of the Germans who fought at the Normandy were survivors of the Eastern Front. If you watch most documentaries, if they weren't killed by enemy fire, died from the frigid conditions, or were taken prisoner, were there many that came back? was yeah. rotation or what?
Yes, they would fight their divisions of, say, a division of 20,000 men. They would fight it until there was virtually nothing left of the combat components, maybe 2,000 or 3,000, a rough, burnt-out shell that would they would take to Germany or France and then completely rebuild. But they would fight it until there was nothing left to fight. And its usefulness wasn't at an end. And sometimes they'd pull it out partially, leaving bits and pieces of the battle groups, the Kampfgruppen, which would continue to fight. But it was terrible to be a wounded person in the Second World War, especially on the Eastern Front. Sometimes, you know, if they received a bullet to their lower abdominal area, you know, the intestines or something like that, they'd be just given morphine and left to die. You know, that terrible gut shot, which would end their life. You know, much better if you're shot in the arm or leg or something like that. But yes, the ability to be evacuated immediately by a helicopter or a plane today, it simply wasn't there. And the crass indifference to the loss of human life in the German military was something that was almost monstrous about them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, Quinn.
Sir, you mentioned you took a quote, a German quote, off of a diary of a dead soldier from the unit. Did you encounter any other diaries or any other like interesting bits from that source?
You come across, in the secondary sources, come across little bits and pieces. You know, a lot of times this was stuff that Allied soldiers brought home and is reprinted in books on the Canadian military or British military or British Army because they're literally taking them off the dead bodies. World War II was not as chivalrous as people might think. And often, if a body wasn't apparently booby-trapped or something, it'd be turned over and stripped of anything valuable, wristwatches, anything like that. It'd quickly disappear, which was a terrible reality, but the truth. And many times, personal pictures and effects were taken as well and did survive and found their way into the hands of historians post-war. Sort of give an insight into the life of somebody just before they were killed or something that. Oh, Tanya.
Yeah, Arthur, thank you for that, that talk. You know, the thing I found interesting when you were describing all this is the tenacity of the Germans. And, you know, you talk about how warfare evolved and so forth, and getting shot in the abdomen in 1944 was no different than in 1814. That you were generally just left there because nobody could do anything. Better to be shot in the arm or the leg. They can lop it off and away you go.
Yes.
But I find it interesting, despite all that overwhelming air power, the artillery, being able to replace everything the moment it was lost, Germans were able to stop the Allies at certain points repeatedly. And I realize this gets into questions of strategy and some of the operations that were done. But do you think that was a function of the leadership that they had from the NCO level up to the officers? Or was it something bred into them that they had to literally fight to the last individual?
They often knew the consequences. If these four tanks didn't hold back this infantry battalion, then, you know, A is going to happen and lead to B and then lead to C. So there's this one case in the book where I describe these four tanks that drive into this hedgerow, and they're a distance apart from each other, but this British infantry battalion launches repeated attacks during the whole day, and these tanks just fire endless belts of tracer ammunition into the British infantry companies, and they reposition themselves in the hedges and go back and forth. So it's very dynamic leadership at the tank platoon, or in the German word for Zug level. You know, that's the word for platoon. And often it was, you know, very small forces attempting to do the most they could with the least amount of resources against overwhelming force. But a lot of this was affected by veterans of the Eastern Front who had been in terrible situations or challenging situations and knew not to lose their head or immediately surrender, but to keep on going.
The corollary to that is what historians were saying in the 1990s, that the British and Canadian armies were crap. And, you know, Jack English and the Canadian Army in the Normandy campaign, a study in the failure of high command and other literature, And now you're getting the opposite, where books like Monty's Men, some of the work that you're doing is presenting the Allies in a different perspective and sort of looking at you know, the Germans and the problems that they had. So do you see this as a shift in the way that historiography is going? Or
I'm seeing it as more balanced now. I would assume that's the best way I could answer it. The Allies had tremendous strength. You know, I go on and on about the artillery, and the artillery does this, and the artillery does that, and it does this amazing thing. And, you know, you see at RMC there outside of Massey Library, that 25-pounder, that is literally the gun that won the Normandy campaign. There is absolutely no doubt about it. And the armies, it's difficult to compare them at times. They have different strengths, different doctrines. What one side thought was important, the other side didn't exactly think was too important. The overpowering coordinated artillery of the Allies, that wasn't something the Germans could ever affect. They didn't have the communications network. They didn't have the resources. And while they had very nice little self-propelled artillery guns that would drive around, they could never have the massive beast that was the Royal Artillery, or had its own command structure and sort of its own separate little universe. And they used, and everything sort of revolved around it like planets around the sun. Yes.
Thank you.
Hopefully that. Oh, yes, Lindsay.
With the ammunition supply, you talked about it from the artillery side, on the German side, were the German tank crews aware of that and used their shells sparingly? Or did they just fire everything off and then...
Was never much of a problem for the German tank crews for some reason, but for the intensive firing, counter-battery fire of the artillery, they could never really do it, or they'd run out. They'd, you know, during Operation Charnwood, there's radio reports that I've seen of, you know, we're out of shells. Fire everything you have right now. We can only last 5 minutes. You know, like it's... but please fire, you know, so desperate calls for artillery, the support that fall on deaf ears. And the soldiers in their bunkers are overwhelmed by the Canadian infantry and British infantry companies that simply surround and overwhelm them.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, yeah,
thank you. Yeah, thanks for the preview of your book. That's pretty interesting, and I appreciate how you're taking that view from the soldier's perspective, as opposed to a sort of a top-down look. I'm curious, did you see... Can you speak to the extent to which these German forces that are standing in front of the Anglo-Canadian armies, the extent to which they're using horses? Because they are, you know, yes. The Germans had were using horses far more than the Allies had these overwhelming motorized forces, and it's sort of something I'm curious about.
Yes, there was favored divisions. The Panzer divisions, Panzer Grenadier divisions, Waffen-SS divisions, and they had the trucks. And then there was less favored divisions, such as the infantry divisions raised in the year 1944 of the 270 series. And those were a lot of which fought in Normandy. And there's many parts of them, not all of them, but many parts of them did use horses. And it's very tragic and ugly that many of these animals were killed, you know, even to the point of being strafed by fighter bombers and machine gunned. It's absolutely ghastly. It's horrible to think about it. But it's the Germans were very crass and very coarse in that regard for the use of animals for their military purposes. And in some ways, 1918, 1917 was not that long, not that far a distance time-wise. So you see a lot of the British infantry battalion infantry tactics, the technology has changed somewhat, but not radically. It was only 20 years ago, in the same way that some battles, I guess, in Afghanistan were only, you know, 15 years ago now. And, you know, have things changed radically? No, it takes a tremendous amount of time. But yes, the German industry could not supply enough trucks, despite it taking over the Ford factories and American Dodge factories in Germany. A lot of people don't know about the Nazis just went right in there and took it over and started building these trucks. But they were never enough. And of course, Russia, the monstrous beast that it was, the USSR, just ate up the German military in the way of vehicle losses that were simply out of control. So yes, hence the massive use of horses. Less so on the Western Front, where the roads are better, there's less mud, and there's a little bit more fuel. Germany is closer. They still have a little bit of the rail network. But on the Eastern Front, things became more primitive, and the horses became much more of a present factor. Michelle? Oh, it's right there. Yeah.
You talked about the human element from the German side. I was wondering, from a historian's perspective, what do you think about the war cemeteries? So if you go to USA, war cemetery in France, we all know it's highly decorated, it's very prim and proper. Go to a Canadian, not so quite. Then you go to a German, and you think to yourself, you can hardly find them, they're off the beaten path, and there's still a young men like that are sitting in front of me that... So from a perspective, they still don't honor, maybe honor's not the word, but there's still a young man that fought for the German. There's still,
yes,
the fences are coming down, there are wooden crosses. From a historian perspective, what do you think of that?
It's a very difficult political question in Germany after the Second World War. How do we do this? And how do we manage and organize and produce and do the gardening for these things? And many of the RMC students, they're very lucky. Every year they go on a battlefield tour and they see many German cemeteries as well. And they see the contrasting, where there's more, you know, flags and celebration and, you know, more people. It's less and more muted with the Germans. But there's still the same resources, maintenance, and initial construction after years of sometimes of negotiation and digging up bodies that were buried, you know, on an afternoon after a battle, just when they grabbed them all and threw them in a mass grave in the process of identification. But the Germans, being the Germans as they are with their organizational levels, everything was put together or reconstructed, identified to the best of their possible, best of their ability. And while they don't have the massive war memorials at the center of each town, there still is that observance, especially with the veterans and, of course, with conscription in the post-war West Germany for many, many years. There is still that military identity. But yes, it's a difficult question. But they do exist, and the Germans have been very careful to negotiate with the countries which these, you know, places do exist. And me and my wife, Michelle, were very lucky to visit one just outside of Rome.
Monte Cassino.
We went to a giant one, and it was is built right into a hill, and it's absolutely spectacular. And, you know, I've never seen anything more. It has this winding path around it, and it's so well designed. It's, you know, very German. But, yes, it's a difficult question. But should the war dead be ignored? I don't think that should ever be the case, because regardless of political horribleness and, you know, the genocide and the Holocaust, these young men still lost their lives for their country, which is, yes, hello at the back.
I wanted to just answer to that question because I'm German.
Yes.
I was born in 68, but my mother was born in 39. The Germans, I grew up in Germany in the 70s. I've lived here most of my life, but in the 70s I was aware of it. It was a very heavy guilt burden that was practiced and it was taken on for good reasons, obviously.
Yes.
And I think that must be one of the reasons why those particular soldiers from that particular period were not honored in the way in which possibly we would honor here on this side, because it was just preached and it was a sort of an inner journey you had to, every school child, every adult had to carry that.
Yes,
and
that generation. That generation, yeah.
Born in the mid-40s, I knew a lady, mm-hmm. and you couldn't mention the war to her. You just couldn't even mm-hmm. say the war. She would say, oh, so alive. And how they dealt with it is just fantastic. The Germans have dealt with it. Very impressive.
Yes. And it's very interesting. If you look at the grave markers, there's very clear distinction between the Waffen-SS and Das Heer, the army, the regular army. You know, and they have the ranks and everything like that. So it's very much organized. It's not, you know, higgledy-piggledy. It's, you know, it's just... Oh.
Just to add on to what she said, and with that lady there. So when we did go to Monte Cassino, the reverence for the markers was very interesting, because even if they found a piece of a person, they would, the soldiers were buried 3 deep on either side of the markers. But even if they found a piece of a person, they made the marker, and it was Ein Soldat.
they didn't have a name for it, but they gave that person the marker, regardless of a hand, a foot, or whatever. And so in Monte Cassino, it was absolutely, it was pristine. The grass was pristine, the graves were pristine, and the reverence to those who didn't have a name was there too, which I thought was really, that was very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And a very important difference is also every Canadian soldier gets their own spot, their own grave. But with the Germans, due to space considerations and the feelings of some countries, they're buried three deep.
Six deep.
Three
on the front side and three on the back.
Three on the back side, yes. Wow.
Yeah.
So it's very much a space management type. Yes.
I just also wanted to address a nice comment about Canadian war. I am of a generation whose fathers went to war. I, with 130 others, were on a tour last year, and we were in the CBC parade live from Holland because my father's regiment liberated Appledorn. If you go, we were on the Sunday, which happened to have been Dutch Remembrance Day, which is the 4th of May, where Mary Sion and Princess Margaret, born in Ottawa, were in attendance. Those cemeteries are beautifully kept. And what I don't think a lot of Canadian kids don't know is that every Christmas Eve, the Dutch school children place a candle beside the grave of every Canadian soldier and others buried in every cemetery in Holland.
Yes.
The other thing is, if you go to any Commonwealth war grave, they are beautifully kept. And the one I was incredibly impressed with was at Passchendaele Tynecot Cemetery. You can go into each Commonwealth War Graves office in 5 minutes. You can get the actual location and go back, and it is quite something. So I think the Commonwealth War Graves Commission should be commended for their fantastic.
Yes, it's absolutely pristine, and the standard could not be higher.
No.
Oh, yes.
I had a question. So there's been a lot of work on the Normandy campaigns, and as Tanya said, lots of people have written about it. In your research, did you find something that was sort of glossed over or something that isn't as prevalent in those works that you found in your primary sources or your secondary sources when researching this, either volume one or two?
Yes. Something that I did find interesting was some of the conduct of the battalion commanding officers for the Germans, for the Waffen-SS Panzer Grenadier battalions, as their soldiers in their bunkers were getting overwhelmed and overrun and captured by the British Army during Operation Epsom, this massive attack that is largely unknown outside of Normandy or outside of the United Kingdom. A lot of these officers, Bernard Siebkin, Wilhelm Monka, the famous war criminal, they managed to escape. They saw the tanks and they were whisked away. So while all the soldiers staying with their men and fighting to the end, it was some of them fought very hard and some were captured, but others managed, they saw the writing on the wall or the wall of British tanks, a wedge of British tanks and attacking, and managed to escape to fight another day. So I found that interesting. It's not something that is widely known, but I tried to include a lot of that, those personal stories and the details. And it is a book. It is what it is. It's a book of details. And I go right in there, every last tank, every, strength of every battalion, the fate of every officer. It's not a perfect 100% picture, but I do the absolute best I can to push that detail as hard as I can. Oh, yes?
So I know very little about the war, really, but the few documentaries that I have seen, I can hear a lot that the so difficult because of this hedge warfare.
The hedge warfare, the bocage.
Yeah, and so you mentioned that the Germans had some strategies that they were using that were somewhat different, and that they were rather clever, different from what the Allies were using. So do you have the sense that this terrain basically nurtured a new sense of quickening in the strategic thinking of both sides, and that the Germans, perhaps because of prior knowledge as well in the Eastern Front, you were saying, there was this novelty in execution and strategy, or was it just some... do you have anything to say about that
It became a war of ambushes. You know, they'd place in a field with a bocage a machine gun on each little corner and wait for the American troops to claw their way over the bocage and then machine gun them, and they'd fight that battle for a couple of hours and then go back to the next field and on and on and on. And it became very apparent the American First Army was getting nowhere. So we see these very large British offensives in areas where tank warfare is much more conducive, and the farmers' fields are much, much bigger. And we have Epsom, and we have Martlet, and we have Windsor and Charnwood, and it just chews through the Germans. But the Germans are drawing in all their best tank divisions because they feel very strongly that this is where the decision will take place. Either they hold them, we hold them, or the British Second Army will break through. And so they dump in more and more resources to get to the breaking point where they become so weak on the Western Front. The U.S. First Army launches Operation Cobra and a massive bombing campaign, and the U.S. infantry battalions saying, you know, bocage, smokage, we're going to chew our way through. And they launch this dynamic infantry battle that eventually allows the U.S. armored columns to break out. But can never say anything bad about the British Second Army and the First Canadian Army, because we were literally fighting all the German armored divisions all at once. And while there's a couple of, you know, scripts, you know, dribs and drabs of armored units against the Americans, the vast majority, well over 90%, were fighting in the Canadian Army and the British Army in Normandy. That's where the tank battles, the Titanic Clash of the Titans events, that's where they were taking place, just beside Caen, right into June, July, August. Yes. So, yes, one more.
Yeah, sorry.
No.
I'm just curious. You studied the other side of the hill more than anybody I know. And I'm just wondering, with what you've learned about how the Germans fought, particularly the SS units, when you look at the historiography by British and Canadian historians, do you view that differently in how they portray the enemy?
Yes, it's sort of, you know, they do describe in detail some things, but there's large areas that are very much unknown. And, you know, hopefully I've placed some light upon some of these areas, how they thought, how they deployed, what the strength of their units were. You know, did they operate at night or during the day or a bit of both? You know, all those sort of details. And some of the things that are written, you know, like the Germans weren't very good at night. You know, that's ridiculous, because that's when they came out of their little holes and they're very, very active. So, you know, stuff like that, it's, you know, that's not true. But, you know, other stuff is... But as with anything, a good historian has to consult all the sources, and suddenly the picture is somewhere in between. All right. Well, yeah, feel free to answer. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming out. And, yeah, it's my pleasure.
And you just heard in this second hour now, and following the remainder of that first hour's book launch event, again in this hour, then you heard from a Novel Idea Bookstore launch event held, I believe it was April 15th, and not the date I gave at the start of it. So, but there you heard Arthur W. Gullickson reading from his new book, Volume 2 of The Defeat and Attrition of the 12th SS Panzer Division, Hitler's Jugend. And I would like to thank Arthur, and all those who attended, who were included in the conversation for that wonderful event this evening, and of course the Novel Idea Bookstore. It is about 54 minutes after 5 o'clock. I only have a few minutes left here, but I really should do this first, and then I'll be right back.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evenings from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
Hey, hey, hey! You want to kick the summer heat and get a nice treat? Don't hesitate to make a date to visit Old Farm Fine Foods. Pizza, frittata, sausage rolls, sandwiches, soups, and more are ready and waiting to get in your belly. Plus, you can also buy fresh and frozen food to prepare at home. Pop into the shop Monday through Sunday between 8 to 6 at 204 Berry Street. And don't forget to follow Old Farm Fine Foods on Instagram at OldFarmFF to get the scoop on the latest goodies. Old Farm Fine Foods, comfort food you can count on.
Hello and welcome to Salt Licht in Rapture. I'm your host, Nishan Tung. Salt Licht in Rapture is a sonic exploration of, to quote Virginia Woolf, violent waves of emotion. Featuring both known and lesser-known musicians and poets, a special emphasis is placed on oddball, enigmatic, outsider artists whose work invokes dreamscapes and feelings of alienation, nostalgia, melancholy, existential unease, and yearning. Join me on Fridays at 8 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could borrow a musical instrument free of charge, just like you can borrow books from your local library? We think so too. That's why the Joe Chitlin Memorial Musical Instrument Lending Library, also known as Joe's Mill, has been lending guitars, keyboards, saxophones, and many other instruments to the Kingston community free of charge for almost 20 years. We are a registered charity, relying solely on the generosity of our community to donate their time, money, and instruments to keep this amazing service alive. Find us at www.joesmill.org or Joe's Mill on Facebook for more information on borrowing instruments or contributing to Joe's Mill.
Your library, your story. At the Kingston Frontenac Public Library, books are just the beginning. A library card starts a lifelong adventure, connecting you to everything you need to inspire learning, creativity, and fun. With 16 locations and plenty of online services, using your library has never been easier. Study in a quiet space, meet friends and learn new things, or explore the world through a magazine or a museum pass. Become a part of our story. Visit your local library branch or find us online at kfpl.ca.
And first of all, I should just say that you are listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. It is crowding 58 minutes after 5 o'clock. First of all, I'd like to thank all of you out there for tuning in today. And in this hour, thank all of those who took part in all the book launches and reading and conversation. Both of those evenings, and to Novel Idea, Oscar, Joanna, and Nicola, as they do as an indie bookstore, for what they do for readers and writers as an indie bookstore here in Kingston. Thank all of those who took part in the show today. And you are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And don't want to forget, please, just a reminder that every week I upload both hours of this show to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. They do remain there for 3 years, or maybe even closer to four, but at least 3 years. I usually get that uploaded just before 7 p.m. When I get home after this show, but tonight I'm going directly from here to Novel Idea Bookstore again for another book launch event that I'll be recording. So it's going to be more like 9:30 or maybe even 10 o'clock before I get today's shows uploaded to that blog space. Again, finding a voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. I do hope you can stay tuned in just less than a half a minute now to 2 hours of East Coast music in a show called Saltwater Music, hosted by Rob Carnell, coming up right at the top of the hour. And I hope you all have a very wonderful week, and I do look forward to catching